Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge listeners who care about, or care for, or may themselves have become someone with a disability. On Friday, November 10th, the Globe and Mail announced that Atlanta's Center for Disease Control was reversing its historic position on chronic fatigue syndrome and promoting an awareness program for physicians and the public that chronic fatigue, or CFS as it's known in the States, ME here, is a real disability deserving of medical treatment, and as many as 100,000 people in the States may have it. In honor, we're going to replay an interview with lawyer Hugh Scherer about a sum of money awarded to a CFS sufferer for being unfairly fired in Brampton. It's now being appealed, and you'll hear the results from us when that comes through. For now, revisit the interview with Hugh Scherer about chronic fatigue and discrimination. Hugh, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You have a very interesting case here and a precedent-breaking case as well. Kevin Keyes has been awarded, and Honda has appealed, $500,000 in punitive damages for being fired as a sufferer of chronic fatigue.
That's correct.
How did you come into this case when you picked it up?
I was initially retained by Kevin prior to the termination of his employment for the purpose of trying to negotiate an appropriate accommodation for him and his condition at work.
Right.
Kevin had been accommodated for a period of time, and then what happened is the employer, once they got my letter requesting to try to clarify the situation and try to improve the accommodation because it was causing problems for Kevin and problems for the workplace, in that Kevin was made to be more absent than he needed to be because of the accommodation put in place by the employer.
The accommodation forced his absences?
Well, they caused him to be more absent than necessary. For example, one of the requirements was that every time he was absent, he had to, while he was off, obtain a letter from his physician so that he could produce that upon his return to work before they would allow him to return to work.
Oh.
And so, you know, if he couldn't get in to see his doctor for a day or two, he'd be absent an extra day or two when he didn't need to be. And what we were trying to do was to address that.
Right.
We had no problem providing medical notification or certification, but the fact that such requests were making him more absent than necessary was a serious concern for us, as it should have been for Honda. So we were trying to address that. We were trying to address issues of that sort to try to make the accommodation work for both Kevin and for Honda. And what Honda's response to that was is, first of all, to totally disregard counsel's intervention at all, just to totally ignore counsel, refuse to communicate with counsel, continue dealing with Kevin directly.
Right.
And even though counsel advised that, and I advised that, this kind of interaction was causing more stress and was causing Kevin's condition to become worse as a result, and thus making him, you know, more absent than he needed to be. So despite that, they continued on that same path. And so that's how we got into this. And then what they did in response to our letter.
Which letter?
Well, our initial letter.
Okay.
It was on March 16th in 2000, and then on March 21, 2000, they had a meeting with Kevin, and they basically told Kevin that they're no longer going to be accommodating his disability, that they didn't believe that he had a disability which warranted the kind of accommodation he was receiving, and that they wanted him to go see their company doctor, again, a new company doctor, after he had already been to see a company doctor, you know, several months prior.
Right.
And in essence, all of these things were done in retaliation for the fact that Kevin had retained counsel to try to work cooperatively on his behalf with the employer. And the judge found as a fact that Kevin's actions were a model of conciliation.
I see.
And that he was eminently reasonable in that respect, and that Honda, you know, refused to interact with him in any way, and that they chose then to terminate his accommodation and eventually to terminate his employment as retaliation for the fact that he had hired a lawyer to try to help negotiate on his behalf.
What is Kevin dealing with?
Chronic fatigue syndrome is a complex, debilitating condition. I mean, its impact on people will vary from person to person, but what it primarily consists of is a situation of chronic pathological fatigue. We're not just talking about regular tiredness that one would experience after exertion or after engaging in some activities for a period of time. We're talking about a chronic pathological tiredness, including physical tiredness, emotional tiredness, and difficulties with sleep. That comes from first off, a sleep disorder, the inability to sleep and obtain restful sleep. In other words, when we sleep at night, we have a period of sleep that we call REM sleep, or rapid eye movement sleep.
Right.
And what that is, that's the dream sleep. That's that deep sleep where, you know, you're really deep and you're really into it. Well, for people with chronic fatigue syndrome, it's quite common that they're not able to achieve REM sleep. They're not able to achieve that kind of REM dream sleep.
Right.
And as a result, when they wake up unrefreshed. They wake up not having slept fully and properly the night before. And this can have significant impacts both in terms of their abilities to concentrate, to stay focused, their memory could be affected. And it also, again, leads to this kind of pathological, physical and emotional fatigue that then impacts on their abilities often to engage in some of the most routine activities of daily living, whether it be the ability to get up and go to work or the ability to go and do grocery shopping, the ability to clean one's home or set the table or anything.
Cook it sounds like the effect is cumulative.
It is, and again, the nature of the syndrome is such that the symptoms include, first off, this kind of pathological fatigue. It can also include for many people, and it didn't significantly for Kevin, but it can for many people incorporate a significant amount of chronic pain.
Yes.
So you're often experiencing conditions of chronic pain, basically all over body pain, a feeling like you have the flu, basically
right.
24 hours a day. That just never goes away.
Yeah.
And it just can be very debilitating for people. And you have to try your best to cope with the symptoms and cope with the condition and to function as best you can. But in certain instances, you know, it's made that much more difficult, particularly where you're under significant amounts of stress, particularly where you're pushing yourself beyond your limits and where you're being or having imposed upon you.
There's not a lot of traditional medical support for this disability either.
There really isn't a lot. I mean, they're learning more and more. Last year, they published a new clinical case definition and treatment protocol for chronic fatigue syndrome and for fibromyalgia syndrome, which is a related condition.
Who published it?
It was done under the auspices of Health Canada, and it was a panel of medical experts. And I was, in fact, one of the contributing editors on the occupational disability section of the journal articles. But it was done, as I say, under the auspices of Health Canada. It was a select panel of medical experts from around Canada, the U.S., and Europe.
Right.
And it's probably the most comprehensive clinical case definition and treatment protocol set out around the world for purposes of dealing with, assessing, and treating chronic fatigue syndrome as well as fibromyalgia syndrome.
So you say this is a superior protocol to anything officially accepted in Europe or the U.S.?
Well, I mean, the standard protocol that one refers to is that produced by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta.
Yes.
And the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta protocols are very much research protocols.
Right.
So their real purpose is to assist in conducting research on these conditions. They're not particularly oriented towards clinical practice. So what the Canadian protocol does is it takes those research protocols, it's very much in keeping with them, but it really does expand upon them for purposes of clinical practice. In other words, what is the family doctor dealing with, treating and dealing with a patient with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia?
Okay.
These treatment protocols and clinical case definitions look at that. They look at what is the actual diagnosis requirements for these conditions and what are the appropriate methods of treatment. And you're right, there isn't a lot of conventional medical options available, and it's quite common that people will pursue, in conjunction with the more conventional medical approaches, natural medical approaches in order to try to alleviate the symptoms and be as functional as they can be.
Well, these natural approaches aren't well supported by public health either. So let's return to Kevin. In our scenario now, it's 2000. Kevin's been fired. He's got a lot more stress because he's been unjustly let go from work. He's probably angry, and justifiably so. He has no money, and you take him on for a lawsuit.
Yes, well, I mean, Kevin had dedicated 14 years of his life to Honda.
Right.
He had truly bought into the Honda corporate philosophy, and basically what, in my view, happened is that as soon as he was no longer sort of perceived as able to live up to their expectations, or as soon as he was no longer sort of fitting the Honda norm,
mm-hmm.
then he was really discarded, and it almost became a personal attack on him that this litigation persisted in the way that it did.
Is this a cultural thing, a business thing, or just a Honda thing?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
You'd have to really speak to people at Honda about that, but I certainly believe that probably there are aspects of all of those things that were at play in this case. There's no reason why this case had to happen the way that it did. It could have easily been resolved early on if there was willingness on the part of Honda to do so. And the fact of the matter is they never made any attempt to resolve the matter at all.
Okay, so they made no attempt to resolve it. They've been slapped with a $500,000 fine. Apparently the judge, according to the article that I picked up, says that just because Mr. Keyes did not carry a white cane, use a hearing aid, or get around in a wheelchair did not make him any less deserving of workplace recognition. He continually had to earn any accommodation. Honda ignored the fundamental principle of human rights law that accommodation is a right and not an indulgence, or worse yet, an act of charity. What happens to Mr. Keyes' award, and what happens to the case if it's appealed?
Well, at this point, the point of appeal, what would happen is that the award would be put on hold, pending the hearing of the appeal, which could take as long as a year.
Right.
To schedule with the Ontario Court of Appeal.
Oh, to schedule and then to hear.
Well, yeah, the hearing itself shouldn't last more than a day or so.
Oh, okay.
But because at this point we've already heard all the evidence, there's not going to be any evidence called at the hearing. I mean, the evidence was heard, the facts were considered by the trial judge, and those factual findings are going to prevail even in the course of the appeal. The appeal is not going to subject those factual findings to scrutiny. It's really an issue of legal errors, or if any.
I see.
On the appeal. And again, I'm confident that the appeal will be successfully resolved. In the meantime, it means another year. And in the event that there is further dispute after that, it could be appealed further to the Supreme Court of Canada, which could take up to 3 years to resolve.
You're listening to www.radioforall.net while we take a short break from our interview.
I've been warped by the rain, driven by the snow. I'm drunk and dirty, don't you know? And I'm still willing. And I was out on the road late at night. I seen my pretty Alice in every headlight. Alice, Dallas, Alice.
And I've been from Tucson to Tucum, Kerry. The Hatcher beat a ton of ball, driven every kind of rig that's ever been made. Driven the back road so I wouldn't get weighed. And if you give me weed, white sand wine, and you show me a
the wind, robbed by the sleet, had my head stoked in, but I'm still on my feet, and I'm still willing. Smuggled some smokes and folks from Mexico, baked by the sun every time I go to Mexico, and I'm still,
and I've been from Tucson to Tucum, Gary. Driven every kind of rig that's ever been made. Driven the back road so I wouldn't get weighed.
And if you give me
weed, white sand wine, and you show me a sign, I'll be willing to be.
You've been listening to an archival interview with lawyer Hugh Scherer about a sum of money awarded to a CFS sufferer for being unfairly fired in Brampton. It's now being appealed, and you'll hear the results from us when that comes through. For now, revisit the interview with Hugh Scherer about chronic fatigue and discrimination.
It looks like a landmark for people with invisible disabilities in general, the nature of the judge's decision. Just because he didn't carry a white cane, using hearing aid, or get around in a wheelchair didn't make him any less deserving. Do you see it as having that kind of effect?
I think that there has been an increased recognition of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome over time.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that there's more work to be done. But certainly this case and others like it do open the eyes up of the public and of large corporations and governments of the implications of these conditions, how they interact with the workplace situation, and what needs to be done to ensure that people are able to contribute as effectively as possible in the workplace setting. And if they're not able to contribute, that there are benefits made available to assist them until such time as they are able, if they are able to improve to that degree at all. I mean, most people with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia are able to work at some level.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a significant portion of the community which frankly simply are not, because of the variability of the condition, the
right.
unpredictability from day to day on how one is going to feel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, employers require that employees attend at work regularly, that they be punctual, that they attend at work able to carry out the duties of their job. And if you're not able to know how you're going to feel from morning to morning, it makes it very difficult to maintain any kind of regular schedule.
Well, it seems from what's happened with Honda that, that the public attitude, never mind the employer's attitude, would be, is this guy really sick?
Well, there was a lot of that, and there was actually specific incidents. I mean, when Kevin would walk in after a day's absence the next day, you know, people would rise and clap and sort of mock and ridicule
oh, really?
His condition. I mean, one day he came in, there was a cartoon left on his computer. It was like a picture of a dog rolling over and says, you know, he's not really great at playing dead, but he's really good at calling it sick.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, certainly there were real attitude issues in the Honda plant that contributed to the problems that Kevin was facing and that Honda failed to respond to in any meaningful way. And the judge remarks upon these as well.
I take it his family is behind him?
Well, his family is behind him, absolutely. I mean, they've watched this gentleman work for 14 years at a job that he's loved with a passion
mm-hmm.
and that he's committed his life to. And then they've watched how this company has really just washed its hands of him and tossed him aside like a piece of garbage without in any way attempting to work in good faith to try to resolve the issues that may have enabled him to continue on his employment with the company. I mean, there was a clear decision on the part of the employer to say, look, we're not going to pursue this any further, and it's our way or the highway. And what Kevin said is that I'm not prepared to simply be abused by the company.
Yeah.
He retained a lawyer in order to assist to communicate these views.
Yeah.
And we did so. And what the judge ultimately said is that, yes, he should not have had to been abused. What he was asking for was eminently reasonable, and that it should have been provided. It wasn't provided. There were ultimatums based on misleading interpretations of medical evidence and misinterpretations of situations by the company.
Right.
So they were, in essence, making ultimatums without stating accurately what the facts were. They weren't even relying upon the true facts of their own physician's reports.
So it appears that they distorted the facts.
That's why there's such a high award. And the judge found as a fact that Kevin proved that Honda engaged in a litany of acts of discrimination and harassment.
Yes.
Including the termination of his accommodation without any kind of notice or warning or a protocol to deal with the issue, and including the kinds of acts that I've spoken of before, the cartoon and things of that sort, and including the actual termination of his employment itself, when they knew or ought to have known that they had no right and to terminate his accommodations, and by doing so to terminate his employment.
I see.
And the judge clearly made those findings as a matter of fact, that Honda had no just cause to terminate Kevin's employment, and that it engaged in a pattern of discrimination and harassment that amounted to what the judge called a corporate conspiracy
right.
to terminate Kevin from employment. I mean, those are very harsh findings, but they are in fact accurate findings if one reviews the evidence.
Do you feel that awards of this kind are an integral part of recognition of the right to accommodation for disabilities?
Well, the Supreme Court of Canada in the Whiten case has said that, you know, where you're dealing with big corporations, it's important to have, and where you have such egregious conduct, such reprehensible bad faith conduct, that it is important to sort of, as Justice Binney said, to give them a big whack, to wake them up to their responsibilities.
Right.
That's what the Supreme Court of Canada said
right.
In the Whiten case, which was the first case ever to grant $1 million for punitive damages in an insurance context.
All right.
So, I mean, what this case does is apply those same principles in the employment law setting,
mm-hmm.
Which is a very different setting because there's no fiduciary duties or trust obligations in the employment law setting which exist in the insurance setting. So what the court did here is to apply those kinds of principles and to say, look, you know, where an employer engages in this kind of reprehensible, scandalous, high-handed, bad-faith conduct, which is discriminatory and which just is a total failure to accept their obligations at law, to accommodate or otherwise, that the employer has to be held responsible, and that where they engage in this kind of conduct as a means of a corporate conspiracy to terminate one's employment, then they ought to be held accountable for that, and that's what the court did in this case.
Yeah. This is a kind of extreme remedy for someone who finds himself poor, as Kevin does. It's probably fortunate that he engaged you while he was employed.
Well, his purpose in doing so was simply to try to facilitate an appropriate accommodation for so that he could continue to work and continue to make the most significant contribution that he could at work.
Well, and that demonstrates his commitment, in fact.
Absolutely, and the judge found that as a fact.
Yeah. What do you see any hope in this upcoming Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, or in the existing mechanisms, the Ontario Human Rights Commission, or even legal aid for people who've lost their work and have no income, in rectifying these issues so that they need not go to civil cases to resolve them?
Well, I think that the Ontarians with Disabilities Act provides for a kind of systemic approach remedying various barriers to social, economic, and political participation
right. For
people with disabilities. In that respect, it's a very significant step. Unfortunately, it's not clear how strong the legislation is actually going to be
right. And
how far it will, in fact, go. I mean, the goal should be complete access and removal of all barriers to full participation in society, just as any citizen of Canada should have the right to. So that's certainly a positive means. I have serious doubts about the effectiveness of the Ontario Human Rights Commission and its ability to meet these challenges. In fact, one of the issues that we dealt with in this trial was the fact that we didn't go to the Human Rights Commission for those very reasons.
Right.
And we sought a claim for discrimination and harassment as a matter of tort and contract law outside of the human rights process. And it's a 1979 Supreme Court of Canada decision which says that if you want to pursue discrimination or harassment issues, it has to be done through the human rights process.
Right.
And that is such a lengthy, delayed, and ineffective process, in my view, that it makes it almost impossible, but certainly very difficult. And it imposes limitations, like the limitation of only a $10,000 kind of punitive damages type award, which in this case would have been totally inadequate.
But you used tort law to approach discrimination and harassment.
We did, and the judge reluctantly had to reject that because the Ontario Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada have not accepted that view. So it's likely that when this matter does go to appeal, that's another issue that the Court of Appeal will have the opportunity to address, because we will be raising it to their attention in order to address it in the circumstances of this case.
Do we hope that the ODA will apply this kind of big slap to big corporations?
I don't think that's the purpose of the ODA. I think the ODA's intention is to implement proper protocols to make society accessible, to remove social, economic, and political barriers to full participation.
So it's more preventive.
To punish employers and service providers in the event that they make commitments which they then break by not fulfilling their obligations at law. But it's not intended as a punitive measure. On the contrary, what it is intended as a means to implement full equality
right. For
people with disabilities as Canadian citizens. And that's not a punitive measure. That's just a measure of fairness.
So as difficult as it is, there will always be a place for civil law where these provisions are broken and ignored.
Well, I think there has to be, and I think it would be even better to have a more effective human rights process that enabled parties, for example, to go directly to a human rights tribunal to seek redress for their disputes, like we do in a landlord-tenant type context.
Right.
In the human rights situation, we have what we call quasi-constitutional rights, basically rights that are, as close to constitutional rights as you can get. But to enforce them, it's much easier to enforce your landlord-tenant rights than it is to enforce your human rights in this province, and that's the problem. So I think, one of the measures that Mary Cornish recommended in her report to the government in 1991 was an amendment to the human rights process to enable direct access to the human rights tribunal, and that the commission would then have the ability to investigate and pursue more systemic cases of human rights abuse, but leave the individual cases to go directly to a tribunal for hearing, because in this case it's in the discretion of the commission.
And these
whether or not such things go to hearing or not. In some cases don't. In some cases take forever, and it's not the most effective way to do things. And the commission, of course, is so greatly underfunded and ill-equipped to deal with a number of these issues, and that's something the government seriously needs to look at if it's serious about its commitment to human rights in Ontario.
And these recommendations were not adopted?
No, they were never really adopted, other than to implement a mandatory mediation process, which is helpful. But if you don't resolve at mediation, then basically you're stuck in the same situation, which gets you doesn't really get you very far.
I'm grateful for your point of view today. Can we track this case and call you back if it turns out to be ultimately successful, or will it turn out to be new development?
Sure. Well, I'll be happy to talk with you about this or other human rights-related matters and how we can move forward on some of these significant issues.
I really appreciate the offer. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Connie.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
You've been listening to an archival interview with lawyer Hugh Scherer about a sum of money awarded to a CFS sufferer for being unfairly fired in Brampton. It's now being appealed, and you'll hear the results from us when that comes through. For now, revisit the interview with Hugh Scherer about chronic fatigue and discrimination. Interference. We apologize to our listeners. At the intermission, you heard Little Feet and Willin. And at the close of the show, Linda Ronstadt's version of the same composition. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.